Yeah.
The lobster was gone. I guess that has to do with the times we're in.
He falls. He gets deflated. I have before to blow we get, him up again.
Did you already start recording?
Yeah, I just started.
Fine. I just wanted to say, if we get cut off, sometimes, if you remember one time we did, and just put it on pause and it'll take, it's just super funky modem scene here. So at least in this house, it's like I've got two modems that I have no idea what their relationship is to each other, but it's problematic. So
are you living in a different place than the last time we've spoken?
No. But I'm in a different room because it's a little bit after 9 here, and we're still on heavy duty quarantine of vehicles and people after 9, a curfew after 9 p.m.
Why a curfew?
Because they don't want anybody going out, and Georgians tend to like to go party. So they want to like kill that, you know. But actually, they've done a great job. I was thinking one of the things we could talk about is just the times. Yeah. And one of the things I've noticed about all of this is that, you know what? We're no longer in the teens. This is a totally different time. Everything that was on the table like 3-4 months ago is now off the table in a totally different way. Yeah. But things here have been, actually the Georgians have handled it quite well. A country of about 4.5 million people. And what they did was at the first sign of things in early March, they immediately started ramping it up. They declared a state of emergency, and they slowly implemented these. Some of them, I think to Americans, they might seem like draconian measures, because of course we value every ounce of our freedom. And when you tell us we can't do something, we're like, yeah, wait a minute. but it actually worked. I think we're about 600 cases, but about 125 of those people have recovered. And I think our total of deaths is like 8 or 9.
Really? Wow.
Yeah. And they're already starting the down ramp on getting out. It actually, like for Easter weekend, they did a thing. Now, Easter weekend is like a week later here than it is right back in the States. It's Orthodox Easter weekend. And I made a video on this, which actually got like, the only way you can see the video if you're not me is to go to my Georgian Crossroads page and then tap videos. And there's one called Pandemic Easter. And that one, you will not see it on the feed because they, for whatever reason, maybe the word pandemic just freaked the YouTube algorithms out. Oh, those poor overworked algorithms. No, that shows the city of 1.5 million people absolutely like, you know, some scene out of I Am Legend or something, just mm-hmm. totally empty. And it was quite fascinating. And also the building up to the Easter weekend, they knew it was like a conflict between the church, which is very powerful. The Orthodox, Georgian Orthodox Church is very powerful in this country, and the government. The government had been doing a great job of just keeping the lid on things. But the Orthodox priests, not all of them, some of them said, no, you don't have to come in. But the hierarchy basically said, you know, we cannot forget God during this time. And for a Georgian, that really means going to church. I mean, they treat the church building very, very differently than even the Catholics do. I mean, every time a very, very religious Orthodox parishioner will pass a church, they'll cross themselves. You know, if they see it across the way, they'll cross themselves. And part of it is also the Georgians hate anything that reminds them of communism. And the communists just destroyed so many churches. Really? So it was important for them to keep the churches open. It was just like, what's this pandemic? What's that compared to communism? So what they did was they said people could go, but then the Georgian government played their trump card, no pun intended, and it was They said, but no private vehicles allowed. So for about a week, it was just desolate out here. But I think one of the reasons why the Georgians did such a good job on this, and like I said, we're now, they've allowed private vehicles again. As soon as they did, you know, it would kind of quiet it down. Then no private vehicles. It was like really desolate. And then suddenly, as soon as they said private vehicles again, it's like there are far more cars than there were. It's like every Georgian driver is like, I'm going driving. I think one of the reasons the Georgians did very well is because when the government, whom they don't have a lot of trust in, says things are going to be bad, bad to Georgians means something bad. Because from the end of the Soviet Union, the next 10 years, they had like a civil war. You know, they went without electricity. They had, you know, just dire, dire poverty. In 2008, they had a five-day war with Russia at their border. So the word bad really means something to them. They've seen systems break. And so when the government said, you know, this could get bad, the Georgians said, oh, so they've been largely very good staying at home because, you know, that word really means something to them. And I realized, reflecting back on my life in America, I realized that word really doesn't mean anything to us. Because, you know, the last really, well, we had things like Katrina. Well, that's bad if you lived in New Orleans, you know. But September 11th, that was really bad. 3,000 people died out of over 300 million people. It didn't, apart from changing airline patterns for a week or so, it didn't really affect the infrastructure. So it hasn't been since really the Great Depression that we've experienced anything that is truly gets to the infrastructure of the country. So I think that's why Americans just went out and just like, they just, you know, all the reactions, so many reactions, not all of them, but many of them just seem like inappropriate on both left and right. You know, they just seem like they just don't understand, because I don't think they can understand, because they haven't experienced within the lifetime of the vast majority of people, there is no memory of the Great Depression anymore.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It's like you and I remember our parents and grandparents talking about it.
Yeah.
But we didn't experience anything. You know, yeah. We're post-war children. Yeah. And, you know, bad for us is like, you know, protest marches in the street. Well, September 11th is really bad.
Yeah.
But like I said, that's bad for us. And, you know, it's terrible that people died.
Yeah.
But that's nothing like, you know, most Americans don't really understand what it means to go without electricity. You know,
yeah.
They don't know. I mean, and the first thing I realized is all your food spoils. You have to spend so much time, because I've gone through a little of no electricity here. I did a video that dealt with that a little bit. And I suddenly realized, oh, man, all your time has to be spent essentially preserving food.
Yeah.
You know, that's like number one, yeah. Preserving food and making sure you have the right water. Yeah. So, you know, it's a difficult thing. But I'm actually very glad I'm here. And I've got a couple of friends who are here that I see regularly, American friends, who just moved in February. And so it was important for me to keep them, you know, like, no, this isn't Georgia all the time. But they're pretty mature people and understood that. A couple who, one of them was a teacher at New St. Andrews in Moscow, Idaho. And so, you know, they very interesting. We're having these great conversations, you know, about all sorts of stuff. I wanted to actually see if I could get him to talk online, but he goes, nope, I don't do social media at all. I said, fine, I respect that a whole lot. So, but no, it's been a very interesting time here. And I've been reflecting more and more on where we might be going. And I wanted to get your thoughts on it. What kind of things right now are you starting to feel and see about, like, obviously some things have changed, but what kind of things do you see, feel?
Well, the first thing it reminded me of was, again, life in the Dominican Republic when I lived there, because one of the one of the, so when you grow up in the States and then you move to a place like the Dominican Republic, the one of the big transitions that you get used to is things don't work here like they do in the States. I mean, right. So the electricity was the thing. Power would be on and off. And when things were bad, you wouldn't have power for a long time. If you were wealthy enough, you know, you might have a little generator that you might generate power for certain parts of your house. We'd put a water tank on the roof so that because water wasn't reliable, you'd have, again, if you were wealthy enough, you'd have a cistern that when the water was on, it would go into your house and then you would pump it up into your house with electric. I mean, you'd have all of these systems that you'd run because none of the regular systems would work. And then you'd have things that would happen, huelgas, which are basically strikes. And I thought, you know, you'd have strikes in the States. Okay, there's a teacher strike, or I remember the garbage strike from New York City right. when I was a kid. And, you know, you'd have these things. But again, mm-hmm. even in the States, okay, so a certain little segment is on strike. There might be a tiny little ripple. But right. in the Dominican Republic, when you had a huelga near you, just everybody stayed home. Because right. if you would go out, well, you could get assaulted. You'd get your car destroyed. And so basically the government would let people make a mess for a couple of days and then they'd send in the army, and you knew the army was serious because they'd shoot a few people. Oh, okay, now it's serious. So then the huelga's over and everybody, you know, make a few concessions right. and kind of things go back to normal. And, you know, and so before I actually got to the Dominican Republic, there was a pastor strike because the mission I worked with didn't pay pastors, and the pastors right. wanted the mission to pay, put them on salary, and the mission refused. Right. And so the pastors went on strike and they didn't follow the Dominican protocols. And, you know, the pastors couldn't understand why the mission agency didn't run in fear. So anyway,
right.
So when this thing happened, it was sort of to me like, I'm back in Dominican days in terms of, it's a huelga. We're going to stay home. One of the things that my wife and I reflected on was that unlike the Dominican Republic, where we always had a certain stock of food, gasoline we're always prepared for the ups and downs. We kind of felt a little unprepared. For example, I didn't hoard any toilet paper. And so, that was my initial response. And then what was made clear by, you know, people like David Brooks, Andrew Sullivan, was for the most part, the majority compliance of people with the stay-at-home orders initially. Right. And people were, and I think that's still the case. Now what I think, and then another thing that you begin to recognize is that some people for the most part have, if you're a paper pusher in a, like my wife works for the school district, I work for this church, people who work in offices could work from home. So you mm-hmm. really had a separation between kind of the white collar, middle class, secure, and then the working class and the entrepreneurial class.
Right.
And that's the tension that we see now, because very quickly, you know, who does and who is and isn't continuing to get a paycheck. And the retirees continue to get paychecks and stimulus checks and some of those kinds of things. So then, and so it's, I think, now beginning to dawn on the country that, number one, new normal won't be like old normal, at least mm-hmm. for a couple of years.
Right.
Number two, there could be instability going forward that we in the United States have not really, we've had emotional ups and downs, you know, the Cuban Missile Crisis, but, you know, even 9/11, most people watched it on TV. Even wars in the United States since the Second World War, again, it most of those somewhere. Veterans are dying. No, wars didn't have, wars went on, but they didn't cost you anything. They didn't cost, not too many people you know, again, this is the segmentation. I mean, certain families do military, lots don't. The government, you know, like the war on terror, let's say, in Afghanistan and Iraq, the government just puts it on the national debt. They didn't raise taxes to pay for the war in Afghanistan or the war in Iraq. And so you get a very real sense that the job of the government is to keep the people comfortably numb with respect to this is normal life. This is normal life on planet Earth. Other countries have problems. We keep things quiet. And so now with the, you know, there've been protests here in Sacramento, but I mean, those again are small segments of the population. There are more people who are sympathetic to it, but okay, open the country. But there's a real sense of, will there be a vaccine? What does opening the country mean? Will things spike? If the government says, okay, we shut it down again.
Right.
What will, and you also have a sense of, you know, the different classes and different groups of people. So I know a fair number of people who Sacramento shut down quickly and early, but I know a bunch of people who, you know, well, the stores were closed, but they, you know, they haven't really paid any attention to it. And they don't keep quarantine. They don't do any of that. They just do what they want. So I think there is kind of even though America has proven to be deeply stable and affluent, there's always been a level of anxiety. This has certainly deepened the anxiety because people get a sense of, can we really absorb $3-5 trillion of more national debt without consequences? Can we?
Don't know.
Well, if once we all come out, you know, it's pretty obvious now that, well, senior citizen care, you know, putting grandma in the retirement warehouse with bingo and, you know, I visit these places fairly often as a pastor of a church with older people. Is that a good strategy? And then also, gosh, we had these kids as lifestyle adornments, but now that we actually have to be with them, you know, there's only so many iPads and Nickelodeons we can throw at kids. And gosh, open the schools again because I don't want my kid in my life. So it's very interesting.
Yeah, and I think, well, America specializes in having people who want to fly that flag that says, don't tread on me, you know? So it's like, you do anything and there'll be people who are like porcupines who just bristle completely at anything, any suggestions they don't like. On the other hand, you have people who says, you know, just listen to everything the government is saying, just do this, just do that. It's a weird, weird time. One thing I am feeling is that, in a way, this is deepening the divide that has been growing. You know, it's strange. I'm looking back. I already started to get this feeling. It was really, well, one thing I want to say, it was really nice of the decade to change so quickly. I mean, because the divide between the aughts and the teens, really hard to find. Does it start at 2008 with, you know, the crisis and stuff? But yet, at a certain point, by the time we were, say, in 2014, 2016, certainly by 2017, it was obvious that this was no longer like the beginning of the 21st century. We were in a different time. But this time, it was like, you could almost feel it. I often think that, you see, we had problems naming those two decades. It was just like, well, the official word should have been the aughts. That's what we always used to call the 1900s. You know, it would get like 19-aught, whatever. But that word wasn't cool, and cool suddenly ruled everything. So actually, there's a great quote from Jean Baudrillard. He wrote in a book in the mid-90s, he said, will we ever get to the year 2000? And the more we got there, the more I realized we never did. That is to say, because we couldn't even name. So, there was a reason why Stanley Kubrick named his film 2001, That's because at that point in 1969, everyone knew the decade started when 2001 ended. You know, but then by the time Prince sang "We're Gonna Party," like 20 years later, Prince sang, or actually about 15 years later, Prince sang "We're Gonna Party Like It's 1999," suddenly it was just the rolling over of all the nines into zeros that became important, and suddenly that took over everyone's consciousness.
And Y2K.
And Y2K, right. So what happened was, well, so then where does the millennium even begin? You know, and then you had the whole problem as well, what's the name of it? The British call it the noughties. There are all sorts of people call it the thousands, which doesn't make any sense to me. It's not naming the entire, I don't know, millennium. It's like, and then there are people who call it the O's, like it belongs in a can with spaghetti. You know, and then we got to the next decade, and suddenly, again, like people being this weird sort of media stupid, I keep hearing the tens, it's the tens, it's the tens. I'm going like, we always called it the teens. What does teen mean? Oh my God, teen means 10. Oh, you know, but it's like people, because people, like right now I hear people, they're calling it the WHO, not the WHO, which I've heard all my life.
Yeah.
But suddenly it's the WHO, and then people are making memes about the rock band, the WHO,
right,
and the World Trade or the World Health Organization. I'm sitting there going like, but you know what I see is I see that the teens were building up to something. And you could feel it with, well, there was the whole Trump thing that, and all of the political stuff and the left going nuts and the right digging in on conspiracy theories and stuff. But then you got, as we got towards the end, things, I started to feel these changes. It's like Game of Thrones just sputters out. Star Wars just sputters out. But the Jigger movie does really well, which was really weird. It made over $1 billion, and it's the most depressing movie in the world.
Yeah.
And yet there's a moment in that movie when, you know, he before he shoots the host, where there's a sense of like, yeah. And you can feel it in the filmmaking. And then when the whole city erupts and everything, there's this moment in there. And I know when I sat there, I kind of got chills watching that, going like, oh, they're hitting something here. And I don't even think they know how hard they're hitting it. But then you have like a new musician like Billie Eilish comes along. And in one sense, you can say, well, she connects to Lana Del Rey or these people. But she's very different than these super huge glamorous divas we've had for the last 20 years, like the Katy Perrys and Lady Gagas and Britney Spears and all those people. She isn't that kind of people. She's not a Rihanna or a Beyonce. She wears this baggy clothing, which kind of goes with political correctness, like don't body shame me. But it also relates to how her music is real. All her themes are dark. She, you know, there's one song where the lyric goes, you know, I just want to end me. You know, and there's other songs where it's just like, you just listen to the lyrics and there's just, and yet she's the most popular person. And I see it connected to things like the Joker. You know, it's kind of like Marvel, the Marvel universe ends kind of on a note that made people happy. But then everyone's starting going like, what are they going to do now? Just go completely politically correct, which seems to be the what's happening. And then what happens is when these big franchises start to move that way, suddenly everything just gets ground down into, okay, now you're just making propaganda. You know, not that there wasn't propagandistic elements in all this stuff, but so how polite of the 20s. The 20s is a decade. I thought this to myself, you know, once we get to the 20s, we'll know where we are. Because suddenly we'll be able to actually name the decade and everyone will agree it's the 20s. And it was nice. It was just like, you know, it's like, there's this one YouTube video where this girl goes back and Julie Nolke did this great video about her past self. If you just look, type into YouTube, past self. And this girl goes back, talks to her past self from 4 months into 2020. And her past stuff is saying stuff in January like, yeah, I know that it's like the environment is going crazy. It's like, I know this whole thing is going to be remembered for the Australian forest fires. And she goes like, no, it won't. her future self is saying, your idea of what's a big event is going to change radically, you know. But I think what's happened is you've seen this. I'm seeing also, and it's interesting, 2019, Jordan Peterson disappears from the stage. You know, a lot of the culture war seems to have changed very radically in the last few months. You know, it's no longer quite what it was. We don't know what, in fact, right now, it's kind of like, I keep thinking of two songs. One by Bob Dylan, Times They Are Changing, the lines, the line where he says, don't speak too soon because the wheel's still in spin and there's no telling who that it's naming. And that is this, and the other one is from Leonard Cohen's The Future song. He says, things are going to slide in all directions, you know, and there won't be any room left for the order of the soul or something like this. But I think that's what I see is we're in a point now where really the tectonic plate has just shifted radically. My friend here says, he said this to me about a month ago. He said, yeah, we're officially in the 21st century now. You know, because even September 11th, it's had lots of hangover from the 20th century. And, you know, but now this is totally, because you know what this is? This is the first truly global event. You know, I mean, yeah, the cell phone has gone around the world, but that was a series of just like, you know, this technology has gone around the world, but it didn't happen as an event. You know, we've had pandemics in the past, but they weren't global events in the sense that we're all connected to the same wires now, you know, the same wirelessness now. We're all getting information at once. That radically changes everything. So even if this pandemic isn't the Black Death or the Spanish flu, it is still a massively important thing, more important. For instance, why don't, you know, when you were young, think about this. When did you first hear about the Spanish flu? Exactly. Oh, yeah. You never heard about it.
No.
You didn't hear about it probably till about the late 90s when these books, mid 90s, when these books came out like The Hot Spot, and they started talking about maybe Ebola and stuff like this. But prior to that, you know why? It's because World War I was such a big event. And this just kind of, all the statistics for this just got consumed by the World War I. And then by the time you get through the Great Depression and then World War II, now World War II was a global event, but not in the same sense, you know? You could be in Tierra del Fuego and, you know, World War II, where's that? I mean, it's out there, but it didn't affect you. Even in America, if you were living in, I don't know, Montana, what did World War II mean to you? Well, you had gas rationing and such, but it didn't, it certainly was meaningful, but it didn't affect the world the way this is. And this is the first, I often think we're kind of, we've become insect-like in our use of technology. You know, ants, when they pass each other, will send little messages through their feelers, little electrical impulses that'll tell them, you know, that's where the sugar is, you know? And that's what we become like, as insects just sending off little sparks to each other with our phones and laptops and, you know, all the other stuff we pass through it. So that this is the first event that just kind of goes through the whole hive. You know, this is the first event that just goes, and it seems to be doing two things at once. At one moment, we feel this around the world. And at the other moment, we're starting to see fracture lines develop. For instance, there's obviously a big fracture line now between us and China. But not only that, if you go to Europe, there are big fracture lines in Europe now, where before they had the Schengen dream. Suddenly, you got hard borders coming back, you know, and we don't know where that's going to end. Yeah. You know, the immigration crisis of the teens was putting a lot of pressure on that. But this feels like, okay, you know, there is a very hard border now in the South in America, you know.
And one in the North to Canada.
Yes.
I mean, that border remains closed. And if you're in some place like Lyndon, Washington, which is a Christian Reformed puddle, you know, the churches, that border's closed. And I'm sure you can get across it in one way or another, but.
You got to have a good reason.
Well, and I think you're right. You know, it's in a sense the first. So I read a few years ago, I read this really good book by Charles Mann, 1493, that talked about the Columbian, what did he call it?
Exposition.
Not the exposition, the Columbian, Columbian Exchange. And basically his argument was that globalism began with Christopher Columbus, because once the American continents came online, in a sense, then suddenly Europe and China were more connected. And it's a good book, really good argument. Mm-hmm. But that globalization wasn't as conscious as now that the internet affords, and not just a consciousness mediated through modernist information institutions such as Time Magazine or Life Magazine or Network News, but now, you know, more social media, a little bit more face to face, so on and so forth. So now, this is a moment where globalization is appreciated, but now where globalization is distressed. And, you know, at least for a generation, there will be questions about, well, should we really offshore all of our industrialization, even with respect to, you know, simple things such as face masks, to other countries, or should we keep these things in borders? And you've also got the challenge of efficiency, where, I mean, for decades, they have been fine-tuning supply chains so that supermarket aisles stay full. But what they've done in order, because, you know, redundancy is costly, they wrung all those redundancy out of the supply chains. And so then suddenly we realize our supply chains are thin, and this gets manifest in the United States in toilet paper shortages. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so I think you're exactly right, where this sort of emerging narrative that has been an emerging, and Trump, of course, put his finger on it very early, this emerging narrative of globalism versus nationalism. Right. And now suddenly this swamps even Trump. I mean, you almost see Trump in his daily news things trying to once again get a hold of the news cycle, and the pandemic's bigger than Trump. But hard to believe. Yeah. but then the question is, okay, where are the important lines? And of course, you know, I've been doing a lot of listening to Eric Weinstein, who, of course, continues to assert that globalization, being worried about the Mexican who is not your fellow citizen, your brother in the, you know, the overarching thing of the nation state, that the entrepreneur who is basically running a grift on his fellow country people by, you know, putting out of work the people in Appalachia and flyover country and justifying it because of some helping the poor so that someone in China or Mexico or Vietnam can get a job in an industrial free zone, which of course we had in the Dominican Republic as well. That this so now suddenly you can triple your income at the expense of the nation, but look like you're, so even morality is now contextualized either by the narrative of nationalism, which has been a declining narrative, versus globalism. I'm a citizen of the world. You know, people in Ohio, Southern Ohio, might be sort of poor, but they're not anywhere as poor as rural people in China or Mexico or Vietnam or, you know, one of these other places. So, you know, now suddenly with this pandemic, nations matter more.
Well, and I've been hearing from California, when Gavin Newsom talks, I hear this weird phrase I never heard before, the nation state of California. And I'm sitting there going like, well, what are you trying to say here?
Exactly. And of course, if you drive north of Sacramento far enough, you'll get into the state of Jefferson. I don't know if you know anything about the state of Jefferson.
I know about that. Yeah.
So, you know, while that Southern Oregon and Northern California wanted to secede from their states to become, you know, the state of Jefferson so that they wouldn't have right. all the liberals and, you know, the urban. So, right. you know, also now we see the urban-rural mm-hmm. coming back mm-hmm. into play. So, no, I think you're right. This is, you know, this is suddenly new lines light up.
Right. Well,
instead of the old new lines.
There have been Burger Kings that suddenly no longer have hamburgers. They only have chicken products. This has just been happening. You know, why? What's happening with all the meat processing? And America runs on meat processing. But, you know, it's just and that's the problem. See, I think what's coming next is the real issue. That is to say, the pandemic is one thing. And what that did is, as a, you know, an event, it just, well, you know, if you look at Italy, look at Spain, look at New York City, you see what would happen if no one paid attention to it. And even there, they tried, but it was, you know, it just, so everyone saw that and said, the world suddenly goes, uh-oh. Meanwhile, while they're doing that, how long can we put, you know, maybe if things work out, we'll just call this the great pause. You know, it's like somehow, but you know, the longer it goes on, there are many people, even in America, who just simply don't have the resources to continue, and things will get more intense. But I think, again, as you said, you know, how many $1 trillion can the U.S. afford to pass on? Can we just keep printing money? Yeah. You know, but we might see something we haven't seen since the Great Depression. That's not recession. That's not inflation. That's deflation.
Yeah. Well, you that's know? Why they're printing money like crazy. And the same thing happened. I mean, 2008 was sort of a bump, you know, because they were worried about deflation in 2008. So. Right. Go ahead.
We don't know where we're going. And that's the important thing. And for me, it says, you see, I developed this mentality quite a while ago, where rather than continuing to operate on the principles of daily life and events that I have been operating on, I immediately have developed the mentality of recognizing this has changed. There's no point in pretending like it's yesterday. There's an entirely different set of aims and goals now. You know, so I remember once in Alaska, this was in the last year I was there, I was driving a tour bus. It was a small tour bus. I had 14 people in it, which was basically full. Fortunately, there was a couple of other buses in this caravan. And we were about 20 miles out of, 15 miles out of the town of Haines. But in the wilderness, I mean, you walk 100 yards off either side of the road and you can go talk to bears and wolves, you know. So suddenly I get a flat tire as I'm taking a turn. Not just a normal flat tire, but you can hear the rim. The entire tire is shredded. I've got 14 people in the van, and my brain immediately says, this is where we are now. We're no longer there. We're no longer having, you know, getting people to the boat is no longer the biggest important thing. We were coming back home. Stopping us from going off the road into the cliff next to us, that's the number one goal. And not showing the people behind me just how frightening a situation we are in. So no panic, just holding the wheel, not letting it, just really wants to go off the road, just holding it on. And then as soon as that's done, within seconds, I just picked up the phone, the radio, and I said to the people behind me, okay, we've had a flat tire. I want you two buses behind me to take all the people. And they came, stopped, pulled them off. And then I had to wait for a couple hours as and to prevent accidents on that stretch of the road while waiting for someone. No one called the police since I was left there for 2 hours waiting. Very weird situation. But the thing I see as I can realize, we're here now. We're no longer there. And a lot of people can't do that. They immediately say, I want what I had. I want everything I just had 5 minutes ago. And it's kind of like if, you know, if your house burns down, you no longer have a house. You have to live in the new world. Yeah, you're going to miss all that stuff, but you're in the new world. You just, and I think this event is kind of like that. Because as we go forward, if people act like, I want back what I had, and they can't get it,
yeah,
there's enough of those kind of people, particularly in America, but all over the world, who just can't get used to the new normal, whatever it's going to be.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I'm thinking, too, about networks. One of the interesting things very quickly here were people, a whole lot more people immediately became dependent upon food banks. Mm. And food banks are institutions in rural and urban America where you can basically go to get free food because, right, you know,
there's always extra.
There's always extra. And what was so interesting about the food bank lines, which were the manifestations in these area, like these drone shots of just miles of cars. And so you say, okay, well, what does that tell us about poverty? Because again, in terms of the globalization narrative, someone might say, well, the urban poor in America still have, they have reliable electricity, they have reliable water, they have reliable food, electricity, water, food. They've probably got an Obama phone. You know,
they've got a car.
They've got a car. But this is what poverty looks like in America. And of course, poverty in the third world looks very different. Now,
mm-hmm.
One of the interesting questions is, upon which network is your life dependent? So the people I worked with in the Dominican Republic, I lived in a small town. Many of the people I lived with they cut sugar cane and they picked coffee. But the way they really lived was there were always these little margins of land around the cane fields or the coffee plantations where they would do some basically slash and burn farming. They lived on what in World War II days would be a garden. So the way my grandparents, especially the ones, my father's father, he was pastor throughout the Midwest, they always had a garden and you ate from your garden. And right. You know, my grandfather was a pastor. My grandmother wrote an article, which was written up in The Banner, which is the denominational paper. Basically, you know, 3 cents and 13 pounds of butter because the church, the dairy people in the church didn't have any cash to give to the church. So they would give butter or sometimes a piece of a hog or something like this. But sure. You were dependent upon the network of the natural order, of mm-hmm. the seasons, of the rain, and in many ways for the Haitians, as with, you know, I had a rice farmer in my church here too. Farmers are very dependent on the weather, on, you know, all of these cycles, and they can be fairly chaotic, but for the most part, you can sort of make your way on them. And that's the network you're dependent upon. Now we see how many of us are dependent on networks far down the line from that network. I mean, now mm-hmm. both of us are old enough to remember when things came into season. Exactly. You didn't eat the same foods all year round. Right. You ate different foods during the winter, even in Paterson, New Jersey, you know, sure. most urban area in the United States, you ate winter food. And then when food came, you'd have all of the fruits and vegetables. So you were just closer to that network of, you know, this natural network. Right. And you see now, you know, since I've been living back in the United States, everything is available at the grocery store all year round. Now, it's kind of nice because these things are now available locally during seasons, but they're always coming up from Mexico all the rest of the year or from South America. And so now suddenly when you have a disruption in this, in these other networks that we have created that are responsible for this, gosh, what do we call it? We don't even have names for these things. This stasis of American existence, where the lights are always on and the power's always on and the food bank always has food and the grocery stores are always stocked. And I mean, this life, now suddenly that network gets disrupted and you realize, right, well, nature can be fairly chaotic, but quite long-term and fairly stable. But this network here, ooh.
Well, we don't know is the point. It's yes, too new. And one of the things, well, Georgia is interesting because in many ways we do get food from other places. And I think number one would be Russia. Number two would be Turkey. And then we do get a trickle of things from Armenia and Azerbaijan. And we get stuff from Western Europe and a few things from America, very few. But what's interesting is that Georgia is a tiny country, but it has almost the most biodiversity within a country as small. It's like the size of like Austria. And it's got Alps, alpine things, and it goes all the way down to the subtropical, the Black Sea. And then there's an arid area where it's great for wine production. But the interesting thing is when you walk around Georgia in Tbilisi in the summer, every tree, and there's almost no exceptions to this, almost every tree is either a fruit tree or a nut tree, and the city, or grapevines, and the city just suddenly is green. Everything is edible. It's just like, and I'm sitting there going like, oh, I never tried a mulberry before, you know, and that's a weird plum. And oh, figs, people are just letting them drop. Well, you know, if things get tight, they won't be letting them drop. In Alaska, it's interesting. Now, what's happened to Alaska is going to be really, they're going to be hit very hard because so much, particularly coastal Alaska, where I lived, Southeast Alaska, we call it, gets a lot of their economy, at least a third to a half of the economy from cruise ships, including the Zaandam and the Grand Princess and the Diamond Princess, the first three that had big problems. All of those have at one point or another stopped in my town. So what it means is the entire cruise ship season is wiped out, which means at least a third to a half of the economy for the entire area is decimated. Wow. Which basically means the entire year, because that's going to rebound on all the other industries. Fishing is the thing that's going to keep everyone afloat. You know, and then of course there you need hospitals and grocery stores and police and such. But so their economy's wiped out. But Alaska, especially the area I live in, has one thing that you don't find in the suburbs of Denver or Dallas, and that is we have 5 kinds of salmon, 17 kinds of berries in the valley. Right now, a little fish about a foot long is running in, not 8 inches, 9 inches long, called the hooligan, is running. It was just running last week. And you just go up there and you dip it, and within about 3 dips, you've got about 40 meals. And everyone's down there getting them this year. You know, it's everyone's going like, we don't know what's going on. Yeah. But I can tell you what they're going to be doing. They're going to be picking spruce tips to make tea. They're going to be planting gardens. They're going to be, because no one knows. And I have the mentality of having lived in Alaska for 22 years of kind of like when you're going, one of the things I really liked is that you said, this isn't the blizzard. This is winter. And as an Alaskan, I get that. So back in the beginning of February, I just said to myself, you know, I haven't been a very good Alaskan. And I finally got a friend's car I can borrow. And I'm going to the very big Carrefour store. I'm loading up and making sure I have lots of extras, because I already felt this coming. Yep. And then since then, I just started, you know, I've just go out and get extra cans, extra rice, extra beans, extra stuff, just in case.
Yeah.
And sure enough, and when I got to the point where I had 3 months worth of food, I said, I'm ready for this winter coming, this pandemic winter. Because I felt like what's great is people have not panicked here. So there was never a section time when all the toilet paper was gone. You know, every now and then it would get low. And then just to make a point of it, the next time you'd walk into that store, there'd be a pallet stocked high with toilet paper, basically saying, don't worry about it. And the government has, in fact, said, you know, there are certain basic items we've made sure we've stockpiled, pasta, oil, flour, stuff like that. Don't worry, we'll get through it, no matter what. And the fact, the nice thing in Alaska is this is happening at the beginning of the summer season. So it's, if this was to happen in, say, October, then it would be difficult because there's no way to build up your stock. But I think that for Americans in general who live in these very abstract suburbs where, you know, getting a loaf of bread involves a 5-10 minute drive, you know, this is just totally abstract living. It's like, yeah, you can get oranges in August, you know, yeah, you can get apples in December, you know, let's make it weird, in April, you know, it's like, because yeah, they're coming up from Chile or they're doing this or doing that. But what happens when the supply chains get interrupted? And people's brains aren't like the Alaskans or the Georgians generally. They are in this kind of like, I want it now. And, you know, there's another, you know, I did come up with another reason why we hit the toilet paper so hard in America. You want to hear it?
Sure.
Yeah. Well, this occurred to me when I was first visiting, not first, but after I visited France one year. It was the year I got my first culture shock there. I've been there about 8 or 9 times. This was about the third time. And as I was traveling, I was with my friends and I stayed in the town of Poitiers. But I had so much difficulty finding a good toilet, you know. And it was just so difficult. And finally, I mean, I remember I just had too much good French food. It was like my body was saying, that's it. You got to go. And I was trying to get to the airport. And I was on this train playing, please, God, just let me get there. And I get out of the off the train. And I immediately have to go look for a restroom. This is after about 4 or 5 of the worst restrooms I've run into. And I finally end up sitting on a toilet seat and looking up. And there's just like pictures of transsexual porn all over the toilet. and then it occurred to me, and I said, I get it. The French care about food on the way in. They don't care about it on the way out. Americans are just the opposite. We care about it on the way. We don't care so much on the way in. We care about it on the way out. We want our bathrooms to be a throne. We want to make sure no matter what happens, you know. Oh, you know, in America we have those like shag rugs, you know, under the toilet, you know, that you have to wash because they're constantly getting pissed on and whatnot. But it's like, you know, I've been into people's restrooms in America, bathrooms that are like wombs, you know, they're just like so soft and all this stuff, and they have a little perfume and all, you know, powder and all this strange stuff. And I was thinking like, yeah, you know, it's just like, we'll go buy junk or endless quantities of stuff at Costco. That's just like, yeah, you really don't need like 10 2-liter packs of Coke, but you know, we'll go get that stuff. But we really care about it on the way out.
That's right.
Like, oh, we're not on toilet paper. That's where civilization ends.
Have you, you know, one of the things that I've been thinking about, and we talked about this, especially with reference to the movie Joker,
right,
is how, you know, the echoes from the 70s, and of course you and I both you know the New York area, right. And you know, so Ross Douthats, and thanks for helping with the correcting.
Oh, it was so hard.
His,
he kept wanting to go do that.
He said Douthat. His, you know, that book has really colonized me in his image of decadence as this eternal return, you know, where culturally we're just kind of running the hamster wheel here. And, you know, then, you know, questions about sort of our our ambition for space travel being something of a sign of whether or not we're, you know, optimistic enough. And so it's interesting that Douthat's book really hit just before this disruptive event.
Yeah, I really want to read that.
And that's another way that I really see this, you know, and when John Vervaeke started his Meaning Crisis series, some of those early, because I'd never really thought about shamanic, you know, from a Protestant background, shamanism is just, that's just all BS, you know, but, mm-hmm. but understanding it as a cognitive psychological disruption that affords new insight because you're breaking your normal right. habits and cycles of pattern recognition. And in that sense, you know, Douthat's book of look at how little we've done. And of course I saw both two Netflix documentaries, one on the FIRE conference, which, you know, okay, and then yeah, I watched one on Woodstock. And just right. looking at, you know, because FIRE looks, you know, completely decadent in that. Right. It's right. all marketing. It's all hype. And in fact, there's no there. It's just mm-hmm. this eternal return. It's the shallowness of Instagram versus, you know, so 69, you had Woodstock, which everybody imagines we're on the cusp of greatness. And actually, no. You're on the cusp of the 70s where, you know,
oh, yeah.
where everything falls apart.
By the end of the year, you have the Altamont Rock Festival where you have people getting killed right in front of the stage, you know, mm-hmm. at Rolling Stones. And many of the same people from Woodstock were there. And more than one person has pointed out that rather than Woodstock being the rise of the Aquarian age, man, it was instead the last flag waving of the counterculture, you know, because after that, you know, how many cults showed up in San Francisco in the near the end of the 60s? Well, I can tell you, we did a list at one point and it was something like over 100. You know, how many, you know, it's just like so much. I mean, I look at 1969, I have a friend who was a real San Francisco hippie. He was young, couple years older than I was, but he got involved when he was around 16 years old. And I'd done a lot of research on what happened to San Francisco in the 60s, but I said to him, what do you think of 1966? He goes like, oh, that was just an absolutely amazing year for the San Francisco, like what we now call hippies. And I go like, 67, Summer of Love? He goes, beginning of the end. And I go like, 69, apocalypse. You know, 69, you have such strange phenomena as, well, of course, see, in a way, two things happened within a week or so of each other in the middle of the summer, which kind of made it seem like we had arrived somewhere. And looking back, you can see, no, that's pretty much the end. And one was Woodstock and the other was landing on the moon. You know, we didn't get any further on the moon, really. And Woodstock, we didn't get any further with that sort of thing, even though people have tried. You know, and there were bigger concerts after that, and where, you know, it became either a money-making thing. I mean, even more terrifying is to watch this Message of Love is the name of the movie, very ironically. And it's about the Isle of Wight Festival in 1970, which was not released until the late 90s because it was so bad that they just couldn't, you know, it's just like if you showed people that footage, you know, this is not the kind, you know, like when you watch the Woodstock movie, it's really a pantheon. You know, you have all these people yeah. presented in godlike array.
Yeah.
So that like Joe Cocker's the god of like strange insanity and Carlos Santana is like the god of rhythm and Sly and the Family Stone is like the god of enthusiasm and Jimi Hendrix is the god of electricity. And it's really presented like that, even with the way it's filmed. But if you watch Message to Love, the Isle of Wight Festival, 1970, it's just all apocalyptic. I mean, the song by the Doors, which was sung there at the end, pretty much sums it up. it's like the blue bus is taking us and the driver's going to kill us. You know, you know, and they have people breaking fences down and people harassing the singers on the stage and people shouting at Jerry Garcia that he's a phony and all this stuff. Just absolutely amazing. So, but what's interesting is all of that stuff was hidden from the public, you see. Even the deaths at Woodstock were not known for several years. And there were two or three deaths that occurred there, you know. And people I've talked to who were at Woodstock say it was just like, oh, it was a muddy mess. You know, the rain came. And it's just like, that wasn't fun. I mean, they showed you everyone like clapping and stuff. But the fact is, they were, where were they going to sleep the next night? You know, so it was a, you know, it was a moment, though, that people felt. But by the end of 1969. You know, what happens? Oh, another event in the summer of 1969, Charles Manson. Another thing that happened, oh, the Satanic Bible was released near the end of the year. You know, then the Altamont Rock Festival. And there's all this other stuff that occurred that it just lets you know this dream, it's the psychedelic dream, the idea that we could get pickled in the acid and that our good natures would just naturally take over. But as it occurred to a few people then, I think Tom Wolfe, in his book, The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test, really brings this out. And he's one of the first people to really point it out. But it's been thought of many times then. And I have thought it many times at many events since then. It's just like, well, yeah, so where are the adults here? You know, if everyone's supposed to act like children, you know, having people acting like little kids on drugs and stuff, it may seem fine. You see these photographs of people dancing and they're all like, it's just like, yeah, but what if they have children? And some of them did. And it's just like, now you're acting like a child. What about your child? You know, and in a way, what I'm eventually working towards in my How We Got Here series, which I will eventually continue, is that we're arriving at a place where being a child is the standard adult. Now, you know, it's just like people who will, you know, it's kind of like people don't know how to mature. The word in nature is, or in science, is neoteny. It's when, for instance, a frog retains its tadpole tail, you know, where it never quite matures. And that's what people in the West have become, and nowhere more so than America. You know, we've become these people, and it's all about me. And, you know, and people have tried to tell us this, but it's very hard for us to take it on because I've got to watch the next episode of Game of Thrones. But wait, yeah, what you're saying is right, but I really got to play, you know, get on Minecraft some more. You know, I really have to, you know, there are all these things, these distractions. And I often think, like, the person who understood this earliest was probably Pascal with his whole thought about distraction. He's got a whole section in Pensée, his thoughts about how we live for distraction. And we've never lived in a time where people are more distracted. Which is why I think Joker is a pretty brilliant movie, because what's the clown? The clown is someone who's there to distract you. And now the clown can't distract you anymore. He's become a figure of horror and nightmare. Which to me is like where we arrived at by the end of the teens. But now again, don't speak too soon because the wheel's still in spin.
Yeah,
we don't know where this is going. So it's like, you know, people are trying very hard to interpret all of this according to their lights, say December 31st, you know, 2019. But I don't think those interpretations are going to work.
Yeah. Well, and you know, it's interesting too how, you know, as you well know, apocalypse has become this word for end of the world.
Right.
Which, but it doesn't mean that. No, it doesn't mean that. It means revelation. And right. So the apocalyptic genre has been, you know, the disruption of the networks. If you watch, I mean, the best, even though I've watched a lot of The Walking Dead, the best episode of The Walking Dead and usually of every zombie apocalypse movie is the first. It's the turning. It's the disruption of the of what James K. Smith would call the liturgies of, but I really like what you brought in here. In a sense, it's the liturgies. It's the liturgies of adolescence. It's the liturgies of Neverland, where you're refusing to become an adult. And, you know, again, another point that Eric Weinstein has been harping on has been, in his mind, how he can't understand why the baby boom generation hasn't turned over its wealth to its children. And I think there, you know, I'd love for him to go a little higher resolution on that. I think part of it is that the baby boom generation wealth isn't as evenly distributed as perhaps in past generations. And another element of that might be that the children of the baby boomers are even more childish than the baby boomers, who in a sense made a name for themselves as never growing up. Now suddenly retirement for them meant, well, endless distraction. That became the definition of the golden years, that you know, now you can simply have fun. And then sexually, it's very interesting because that generation also, you know, it was the, you know, it was the STDs in the retirement in, you know, Del Webb, Sun City, not far north of here, that people were, you know, a little aghast at the STDs present in these, you know, they're retired, but not so old as to not. So, and it's fascinating watching this and your definition here of distraction connecting to adulthood and being a child as an adult.
Yeah, you see, I think one of the biggest things that's happened since the 60s, starting with the 60s, has been this, you know, it's been called juvenilization in some quarters. The word adolescence has been used. What's the word? Who uses the phrase emerging adulthood? It's like there's a zone now. I'm 64 now. When I turned 20, I was expected to be out of the house and to be making my way. Now, it took a few years, but basically I did. And today, it's not a question of that kind of thing anymore, because now a person doesn't get to the point I was at around the age of 20 until around at least 30, if that, you know? So, you know, we use the phrase geek to describe people who are, you know, geeks and fans to describe people who are passionate, or, well, passionate's the wrong word, but we could use that word, but obsessed is a better word. Obsessed with all these little things in pop culture, but it can, you know, I've heard the phrase math geek before, film geek, you know, whatever. And what's weird is people, you know, I know that, for instance, for people, say, under 30 or so, they don't even know where the word geek comes from. And it comes from carnival performers who were often alcoholics, who had to get a job, and what the carny needed was more freaks, but you couldn't just create a freak, but that's essentially what they would do. So that's why they would do things like put the heads of chickens in their mouth, swallow snakes, really strange things to make themselves. And swallowing is a really important feature to becoming this freaky persona back in the carny days of the early 20th century. There's actually a great book, Monster Midway, which was written by Lindsay Gresham, who was Joy Davidson's ex-husband. Just for a weird connotation here. So it connects weirdly to C.S. Lewis, but he was like a total alcoholic. But he also wrote this other book called Nightmare Alley, where the term geek was brought into, from the carny lingo, into popular culture. And but he talks about it also, and he talks about how to create a geek in Monster Midway, which was, Nightmare Alley was his fictional treatment, Monster Midway was his reportage. But this idea of swallowing forbidden things was very important to being what is a geek. And I think the aspect of swallowing is still inherent in our geekiness. That is to say, it's, you know, swallowing anything related to, ingesting, taking in anything related to your obsession. So, you know, it's like, I look at people, it's like, I like watching YouTube videos. I'm interested in horror films and such. I've never called myself a geek, even though I probably know much more about many of these things than most of these people who are kind of geeky about this stuff and would use that terminology. And the reason is, well, how do I, what's the difference between an intellectual who is a mathematician and a math geek? Well, the math geek plays games with math. The math geek has in jokes about math. I mean, there might be a few of those among the mathematician, but they know math is serious. Whereas the person who's geeky about something is always, they want the t-shirt for it. They want these little things called Funko Pops, little swivel-headed things that, you know, but they want like cute versions of Leatherface from the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And I'm old enough to have seen the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And I can also show it to you if you've never seen it before, the 1974 version. And it will, it's like someone, you know, coming along with a chalkboard and just scraping glass across it. It's still so powerful. So to make a little friendly, funny, cute, you know, swivel-headed creature out of this, very weird. But that's where we are. It's like, that's why cuteness is such a problem, as well as just the emphasis on fun. And I see that what we've done, I mean, this is why I really, really react to Christians when they start using cute imagery in relationship to the gospel, in relationship to the Bible. So, you know, cute Jesuses and cute biblical
precious,
stories.
You know what precious moments are, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
What, I mean, that's the epitome
of it. Tales?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
You got cucumbers doing the story of Christ. I mean, can this possibly be put into a biblical perspective? You know, and the answer is, well, you know, as long as it communicates the message. Well, it doesn't. It communicates something radically different. Also, I see this, like, it's in anime and manga, it's in Disney, this thing about big-eyed creatures, and we tend to think, oh, these cute little things, they've always been around. No, they haven't. Cute big-eyed things don't predate very far before Disney turned a little rodent rat-like creature into a big-eyed cute creature in the 1930s. And there's a bit of a prehistory of cute children's paintings in the late 19th century. But before that, you didn't find these weird big-eyed things. We tend to think these big-eyed cute things, you know, because we've given them to our children, and now they've kind of infested everything with cuteness, we tend to think of that as some eternal thing, because cute big-eyed suggests baby-like. Sure. And to criticize it is to almost be accused of criticizing a baby, and who could do something that monstrous?
Yeah.
You know, which is why it's the perfect way to smuggle messages in. That's why you watch something like Frozen, the Disney film, and you got these cute big-eyed people talking about me, I've just got to follow my dream. And it's like, well, what is that message? Does that have anything to do with the heart is desperately wicked, you know, in the Bible? No, it doesn't. It doesn't, it, you know, it's just, you know, follow your dreams, follow your heart. Your heart is the most important. Be true to yourself, which is interesting because that's from Shakespeare. And it was said by Polonius, who was actually just full of himself and was a liar. You know, Shakespeare knew you couldn't be true to yourself. To your own, thine own self be true, because we are all fakes on some level.
Yeah,
you know. So, but where we've entered is this zone where that's considered normal. People talk in what is it? It's like when I've heard people. I often see this on television shows where there'd be one character who's just obsessed, and everything is a quote from TV and you know Harry Potter books and stuff. And it's also a knowing kind of thing. It's like we've transcended because we can make all these recent pop culture references. And to which I'm sitting there going like, yeah, you know what? If you really need to get back to reading like Solzhenitsyn, which is what makes Peterson so great.
Yeah.
You really need to get back to reading like Milton. You really need to get back to reading, you know, hey, I'll settle for Edgar Allan Poe. You know, I'll settle for all sorts of people you know, at this point, even Catcher in the Rye seems pretty adult compared to what's going on. I mean, especially then when you dive into things like fan fiction and fan art, it's like there's enough saccharin there to just absolutely send you into, diabetic convulsions. It's just so sweet, and everything is, everyone wants to live in their own, you know, headspace. There's actually a word in fandoms, you know, the kingdom of the fan, but of course fan is short for fanatic. There's a thing where people create their own canon out of what they're interested in. That would be called headcanon. In my headcanon, I see Spider-Man being like this. And so when I write my story of Spider-Man, my fanfic, he has these attributes, because that's how I see Spider-Man. Whereas not allowing the actual thing to get you. Well, of course, if you're starting with Spider-Man as some sort of cultural reference, and you don't have a bulwark of actual canon of literature, it's like, you need to read Dostoevsky. You need to read Shakespeare, see some plays. You know, you need to listen to, when I was young, Leonard Bernstein used to be on television. And he would be telling you about things like Beethoven's Fifth Symphony or Bach's music, Toccata and Fugue in D minor or something. And it was just assumed that an intelligent person would grow up to understand some of this stuff, that it wouldn't just be this. But now it's like whatever a person's into, it's like we're in our own. It used to be that it was really tribal, but now everyone's in their own bubble, their own personal entertainment bubble. And of course, the great illusion here is it isn't their bubble at all. It's being sold and packaged to them.
Right.
And all that fan fiction about, you know, this video game or that book series is still all owned property by somebody. So you really have, rather than extending your imagination, you're helping them find new avenues to sell you things, you know? So that's the thing, is like when everyone's a child and no one's an adult, it means the people who actually are adults and are running large businesses, they pretty much can do what they want up to a point, you know? But then again, I see something like the Peterson phenomenon, or I see Joker, and I see these kinds of things. I see the IDW. And I see these kinds of things where, you know, like one of the great things about, I mean, and you've been a beneficiary of this yourself. People are, you know, how many 2-hour plus videos did you do this week? And yet people are watching them. Yeah. There is a hunger for adult content, and not adult in that sense of the word, but adult as in mature, you know, even though adult freighted with weird connotation, you know. And I,
if I did adult content, I don't think anybody would want to watch.
Yes. Suddenly I've got images in my mind.
I know. It's just horrible.
Call that to play stories for young Christians and seekers. Maybe we shouldn't go any further down
there. No, but I think that's so helpful. You know, I, a number of years ago, Frontline did a really interesting piece called The Merchants of Cool, where, you know, it was abundantly clear that the goal of many commercial enterprises were to alienate children from their parents, because the parents were pointing out, you know, that's garbage that you're consuming there, don't you know? Well, we got to, you know, so let's alienate the parents from the children, and because then we can really market to them and sort of groom them to, you know, to colonize them on our junk their whole lives. And now we're, of course, further into that, and the parents have been colonized as well. And again, it strikes me as always interesting that, you know, I mostly lived in poor communities in the United States, and to go shopping at Walmart or the discount grocery store, or to eat at the buffet food trough how many times don't I see 1 and 2 year olds in the seat of a shopping cart with some cheap Android tablet or phone, and the parents are just feeding, you know, already at this age, getting them started at this, and the knowledge that the titans of Silicon Valley won't let their children have a smartphone until they're, you know, at least into their teens at some point. And it's like, you know, people want to talk about, you know, the social crimes perpetrated against the poor. Well, there's no bigger social crime perpetrated against the poor than, well, let's fill in that digital divide so we can pump this stuff to the children of the poor perpetually. Maybe that'll keep us all comfortably numb.
Well, that's the thing, is we've been dangled images. It's amazing how much of our popular culture, video games, movies, music, has become images that are glittering or images that are exciting, or at least exciting, and that people are kind of held these things out. You don't have to work for them. That's the thing about pop culture. I mean, you have to work in this, that if you're playing a game, you have to like try to get through the levels and stuff, but that's like a compulsion thing. It's not really a working at something. You're good at, you know, you got your thumbs working, but you haven't got your you know, you haven't had to like sweat for it in the intellectual sense. So, but it's we live in a time where I was trying to get to something, but we live in a time where we are, if there is a divide and conquer. It used to be that it was much more so between generations, but now what it is it's almost every group of people. Like they say, it's like the 4-year cycle of high school or something. It's like that. It now it just changes over, and there's the implication that what they were doing is old and stupid, but what we're doing is cool. To which I'm sitting there going, like, well, just look at this from 4 years in the future.
Yes.
It's not going to be cool. It's going to be just as stupid as anything else. But I think that people, what I see is I do see a hunger, and I think humans have a natural hunger to learn and to think that what they're doing is meaningful. And that's what I think Peterson was able to hit. And that's why one of the most amazing phenomena of the Peterson era is that he was getting people to watch 2.5 hour long lectures on the Bible, among other things, you know, that people would watch these things, the whole thing, and then they would go through the whole series. That speaks to me of a deep hunger. It's obviously, you know, what's funny is I've often had people that I told them I started like a YouTube channel, and they go, oh yeah, yeah. And it goes like, your video, and I'll have people who don't know any better look at me and go like, your videos are also long. Don't you know you're supposed to make these short, things that are like sound bites, you know, like 3 minutes, 4 minutes long, whatever, 2 minutes. That's, and I said, yeah, you've been misinformed. I said, like, look, I don't have a lot of subscribers as YouTube goes, but I'll tell you what, when I open up and look at my analytics, you should see how much time people have put into watching my stuff.
Yeah,
I got thousands and thousands of hours in there, thousands. Yeah. And, you know, it's like that tells me something. It tells me there's a hunger to learn. Just as there's these other, and I think on the good side of where we could be is that maybe we've crossed something. Maybe there will be some people out of this who realize I've got to know more than I know now. I have to learn something about life that I don't know now. I think that Peterson thing, it'll be interesting to see. You know, Lord willing, he comes back at some point in the near future, but be interesting to see what his message will be when it comes, he comes back, because I can be, assure you of this, it won't be the same.
Yeah. Well, and I'm, you know, I was just, talk about this, then I'll go back to a point that I was thinking about when you were talking. You know, I tolerate Facebook because there are people there that are watch my videos that want to interact with me, and because I have old friends and stuff on Facebook. Twitter is the glory of Twitter is that it is brief. But I've just been curious about Instagram, and it's eating, you know, looking at Instagram is like going to this, like going to Leatherby's, which is a local ice cream place made by a Roman Catholic family that has just tremendous ice cream, but they give you so much of it. And it's like, how much ice cream can I eat now at this age in my life? But Instagram is just like, it's just so sweet. It's so cute. It's so, and there's a thing from Peter, and I don't know who's handling Peterson's media, but it's like, you know, it's some of that, you know, a crucifixion scene in VeggieTales are precious moments. It's like, yeah, there's a misalignment here, so it'll be interesting again to see what, if anything, there is a, you know, comes from Jordan going forward. But to kind of go back to the adulting theme, you know, it's interesting that if you were a slave owner or a nobleman extracting your life out of serfs or slaves, you needed those serfs or slaves to be adults. The kinds of creatures we're making today would be unfit even to be a slave.
Oh yeah.
And it's interesting that the sort of slavery that we are, the sort of slave colonies that we are creating today are, I mean, again, drones are the better word, because a drone is subhuman, whereas a slave is actually human. And it's very interesting how this process is moving.
I'm not a big Matrix fan, but there's definitely something to the bodies behind everything simply being used to power everything.
Yes.
And I think we have a society where, you know, at a certain point, it's like, well, why do we need the rest of these people? You know, someone will come along, some evil person, and decide to cut it off because they don't produce anything. They don't, you know, they're just simply consumers. But of course, we still need them to power our economy.
We need them to consume. And, you know, in the last looking like last financial crisis, which was 2008, George W. Bush is out there. Go to the store, buy stuff. The government will give you money to, you know, to consume. And now, you know, also, I mean, even back to Douthat's decadence, I mean, a big theme in that book is, you know, lowered fertility rates, global aging is, you know, to what degree a contributor to decadence. Israel is the only industrialized Westernish country that has an aggressive fertility rate, as opposed to Europe and America and Australia and Japan and China. You know, it's interesting. What was so interesting about that book is how these things were tied not just to, GDP, but to, you know, and this for me, you know, continues to get at the question of, okay, well, I would say glory, Sevilla King would say value, this thing that finally matters. The one scale against which we can, the one true measure against which we might actually be able to see change in value.
Well, just as a side note, sometime if you want to frighten yourself, look up this word as an image or YouTube search, kid-dulting. It's the word kid with dult, kid adulting.
Two D's or one D, or doesn't it matter?
One D. It's a lifestyle that people are living now. To live as essentially grown-up children.
Wow.
Exactly. So, But
of course, children don't have children.
Well, that's the thing. These are people. They can't grow up. You know, it's like Michael Jackson saw himself as Peter Pan. He never grew up. You know, interestingly enough, Marilyn Manson saw himself as the Pied Piper, which is a very different metaphor of leading the children to essentially go off and die.
Yeah. Destruction.
You know, but it's full of children. But no, you know, it all comes down to meaning. If things don't mean anything, then, you know, you're stuck in this world. Why read more if what you're reading doesn't produce meaning? That is to say, how many fantasy novels can you read where before, after a while, you're just simply arguing with the trope? So I didn't like that dragon, but I really liked that prince. And I didn't, you know, that should have been a more diverse cast or, you know, whatever. It's, that doesn't mean anything. What means something is, yes, these things have symbolic resonance, but if they are turned like an amoeba, kind of a turn, just eating itself to reproduce, you know, it's just emptying itself to reproduce and not two more like it, a vacuole, you know, it's like, that's often our, something happened in pop culture. And this is a lot of what I spent so much time looking at over the years, where you had something actually happening in popular culture, whether it was, you know, the rock music of the 60s or the movies of the 70s or even the comic books of the 80s, there was something happening. And in the end, what happens is the machine learns how to market and package these things back to you, so that after a while, you have the imitation of meaning. You have the people are far too familiar with, like, you know, people with something like Game of Thrones, and everyone's talking about, oh, that person has plot armor, or this person's arc isn't working the way we want it to. And I think one of the things that are the hallmarks of our age, there's a real cult-like quality to our pop culture. But unlike the cults of, say, the 70s, where you had usually some kind of devious but charismatic leader, something like that, our cults tend not to have a leader. Leaders, whoever is setting the tone, even, you know, J.K. Rowling sets the tone for Harry Potter. But they will turn her or turf her out in a moment
if she
doesn't do what they want.
Yeah.
And so in a sense, what I realize is that today's pop cults are much more like cargo cults. And cargo cults are these strange things where back in World War II, for instance, the Americans showed up in the Solomon Islands and they had airplanes and they were bringing in Red Cross supplies and, you know, they had parachutes dropping out. And what would happen is these quite primitive islanders would see these people and go like, what they actually thought is somehow they've tapped into our ancestors and we want our stuff. And then the Americans would go. And they felt like, okay, we need to rep, because they were getting all this free stuff from the Americans, all this food and you know, buildings and stuff. And they said, how do we reproduce this? So what they would do is they would get old cans and they would set them along a cleared space. And then they would build a funky looking tower and they would paint red crosses on the tops of things in imitation, bad imitation of what they thought the Americans were doing to bring in the cargo. And these are serious cults, but rather than being a cult of canonicity, it's a cult where the actual cult member and in fact they break up easily, these cults, because and turn into multiplicities, because everyone has a different interpretation of what we need to do to get the stuff back. And I think that, for instance, you know, something like Harry Potter has and all the fan-based stuff on it, including what J.K. Rowling is trying to do by reinterpreting her characters, has this aspect of the cargo cult It's like, how do we get back that original feeling of the first Harry Potter books? How do we get back the feeling of The Lord of the Rings? How do we get back that fun I had playing video games? How do I get back the fun of music and stuff? And so people are all sitting at home in their rooms, especially now, creating their things, but what they're making is they bear a resemblance to real meaning. What the Islanders' little, you know, bamboo towers and little bad runways bear to the American, you know, landing strips and flight towers and such. That is to say, you know what, painting a red cross on top of a building isn't going to bring the cargo back. And likewise, I think our culture has become a lot like that, where we just, like, there are these weird, like I said, there's an insectoid element in it, where we're just, like, touching each other, and that's why things spread so quickly. I think the meme is like that, you know. It's amazing how the meme used to mean this thing that Richard Dawkins talked about, how people would suddenly get these ideas at the same time, but now it means little jokey images and videos that people spread around that immediately are spread, you know, all over, and we hope they go viral. People try to make them. But these are all illusions of meaning. They aren't the real thing. So it's like eating a diet of Coca-Cola and French fries.
Eventually, Diet Coke. Diet Coke. Even the sugar taste isn't really sugar.
Right. Let's make a Diet Coke then. Let's get that aspartame or whatever it is, sparking, how do you pronounce it? But let's get that in there. And the point is this, you can go for a little while, but eventually your body starts producing defects. And I think there are defects in reality now as a result of, see, I think there is a real reality. It's not all up to us. Right. And so if we push it too far, I think that what happens is we can push it out and imagine that we're doing all this stuff. We've changed our reality. And then eventually, a little virus goes around, snaps it all back. Or this probably isn't the big thing. But eventually something comes that snaps it back and says, no, you cannot push this rubber band out indefinitely.
Yeah.
Eventually it's got to snap back.
Yeah. Well, there's
that's it. Yeah.
Well, there's an Icarus quality to this, where and I really liked, you know, how you talked about Woodstock. I mean, in a sense, Woodstock is the Icarus moment, yeah. And you know, your friend who said no, 66 was really the peak. Well, 66 had enough of 45 to 65 in it, which was one culture, and so the. You know, the flower in a sense is, it's generative, but it's always to a certain degree parasitic, because it requires now the final push of what the plant has to bring it to climax. Mm-hmm. And then you get the, you know, then you get the decay, which is the decadence of its running down. I mean, again, you really seem to have that in Star Wars, where the prequels were the prequels were just completely hated, and
the prequels were toy advertisements.
Yes. And and now, you know, now of course the latest off, it's been so interesting watching my kids will nearly refuse to see anything from Star Wars. They've got it creates so much disgust in them, which is fascinating to me, because, you know, my kids are far more woke than I am, and you know, just being young and indoctrinated by that which, you know, that which the schools and the colleges have been putting out. But it's fascinating to me. I didn't know much about those cargo cults. I'm going to have to look more deeply into
this
that.
This is something I've been working on, cargo cults, since the 90s. And I immediately started seeing the connections between our society and cargo cults, because I realized, yeah, so much of what we do, I originally applied it to the fans of like music and stuff, how people would try to, you're always trying to get something to come to you by building a little weird thing. So now it's done in different modes, but it's just like, you know, people who go to sports games and they wear, you know, like weird masks and face paint to try to get their sports team going. There's an element of the cargo cult there as well. It's kind of like, we can make it just appear. Because one thing I do think, you know, and I think superstition is rife in this age, you know, and part of it is, okay, so you've got people who no longer take intellectual pursuits as a serious thing, but you also got people who no longer take work as a serious thing. So that both on the working class side and on the intellectual side and everywhere in between, you've got people who don't know how to take life seriously. So instead, you have many, many, many people who are taking it ironically, and specifically postmodern irony. And when I say postmodern irony, I think one thing that people often forget is there's two kinds of postmodernism. There's philosophical postmodernism, which is one whole discussion. But then there's cultural postmodernism, which is pretty much everything that is happening in the mainstream. And that is to say, it's always got, you know, you can't watch a cartoon, a Disney cartoon or a Pixar cartoon or a DreamWorks animation thing without getting loads and loads of like little sneaky other media references for the adults who are all snarky and you know, but the point is this, it's just like, here's the world I want to live in. I want to live in a world where I can talk to people about Dostoevsky. I want to live in a world where I can really analyze things the way they are, you know, and to not have people just blow up. I mean, it's amazing. I've had some recent Facebook encounters. I'm thinking of one friend in particular started wanting me to say that Trump was an authoritarian. And I don't believe that. I just think he's whatever Trump is, as C.S. Lewis says, I can't remember where, but you know, it's better to have the robber baron as your king than it is to have those people who want to do well for you, but what they mean by doing well is really bad, you know? And so he strikes me as being the robber baron.
Yeah,
king.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
But you know, it's like,
it would be way too much work to be an authoritarian. You know how hard it would be to be a dictator? He's much better playing, you know, it's performance authoritarian and then so much trouble for this. Like, go back and tweet about, you know, I'm in charge, but then go back and say, you know, liberate. And it's like, you get to play president on TV.
Exactly. But you know, I do have a modicum of hope that some of these little things we've seen are signs that people are starting to feel the deficiencies, the philosophical rickets, you might say. You know, they haven't gotten enough philosophical vitamin D. You know, they need things. You know, we and this goes back to where we started. So we provided all of this material possession in the West. You know, we've got so much stuff. We've got so much food, so much choice, so much entertainment, so much, you know, sports, so much, you know, media. It's like, and yet it's created people who are, I mean, if you were to, you know, if you really wanted to do a good fantasy, it would be like you came to a culture where all these people had a spell put on them where they were little stunted creatures. And that's what we're more like. We're little stunted creatures who say like this person who was saying something about, I didn't want to respond to my friend and say, oh, I agree. But nor did I want to say, I disagree. Yeah. Simply because I knew he was blinded. And that if I said I disagreed, he would just unfriend me. And I value his friendship. So it's just like, you know what? I don't have to fight about this. I don't care.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I care about which way things are going, but I don't care about little political points. Yeah. I care more about the meaning of things, which is why I talk about things like texture or time or, you know, what the substance of things, because to me, it's asking the ontological questions. It's much more important than the epistemological questions. Yeah. You know, so much modern philosophy is, you know, how do we know what we know? Epistemology. Yeah. Whereas in the Middle Ages, the questions were, but what is it?
Yeah.
And to me, that's much more exciting now to ask those questions. What is texture? What is time? What is color? What is light? What is meaning? These questions to me are, you spend time with those, because the more you drift into this other, what's happened is we've had enough of philosophies of complete doubt that have drifted down to people who now superstitiously believe these things. They carry it to their home relationships so that they break up. You know, it's just like, you see this celebrity cut together for a while. And, you know, just go look at Wikipedia and you'll see, oh, 5 years later, they broke up. You know, we live in this time where all of our relationships are in doubt. The people we look up to are just like that. They aren't solid people. You know, what is solid about a person doing a big performance show of music, you know, a diva or a rock star? There's nothing solid about that person. They are wearing a persona, a mask, as are all of those actors. There are very few solid ones. Denzel Washington is a solid actor. Whenever I watch Denzel Washington, who happens to also be a Christian, but it isn't just because of that, but he's solid. But there's so many people who have no solidity in their lives, you know, and you can feel that these are the kind of people who are often these flashy people that the media spends time on, and people have imitated themselves. But now it's gone beyond that, so that they're inside these fantasy role-playing scenarios. And so they're seeing themselves just inventing their own characters based on all the choices given to them within, say, the game template, which says to me, no, you're not creating anything original.
Yeah.
You know, inside of yourself, you need solidity. So how do you get solidity? You have to ask solid questions, you know, and that's one of the things I like about Hans Rookmacher, his whole what is reality thing. He says the whole point of this was to ask the question, not to answer it. And it's just like, if you don't ask those kinds of questions, you won't get those kinds of answers.
Yeah.
So if you never ask what is meaningful, and if you just assume as long as everyone's having fun, right, then what you will get is fun, whatever that means, but you won't get meaning because you're not asking the question.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think that's a good place for us to wrap up. I think our
sounds good. We've been going on for a while here.
2 hours, and it's hopefully.
Well, I always enjoy talking to you, Paul. I feel
I do too. And you should make a little plug for the projects that you're working on now.
What am I doing?
Your YouTube channel.
Yeah. Well, I've got three channels, but I'll only mention two here. If you go there, you can find out about the third one. But the main thing is The Anadromist is where I'm dealing more with these kinds of questions, the more like, you know, thinking questions. And I have plans, for instance, to deal with one. I did a couple on symbolism. I want to get to one where I do symbolism in horror films.
That sounds fun.
Quite a bit. Yeah, I've been thinking about the best way to do that. And I want to do a second one related to that on beauty in horror films, which is even more contradictory. Yeah. But I'm also trying to finish up, eventually I'll finish it up, the How We Got Here series, because there's so much more to say. I got stuck because the next one was how the culture war started. And I'm coming through with like a tank and rolling over both the right and the left, the fundamentalists and gay feminists, whatever. It's just because I can see like, yeah. And then it was all propaganda. Welcome to the 80s, you know?
Yeah.
So I've been trying to figure out, because I want to do it in such a way is that I really make my point with examples. That is, say, it's not just me talking. I just thought, then this happened, and just point to it. So I've been kind of stuck there, although I thought about jumping over it because I can do all the next ones pretty quickly. But I've been, you know, carrying that. Over on my other channel, Georgian Crossroads, that's where I talk about my life here in Georgia. And I did a series on what the pandemic has been like here, which is, like I said, one of those actually got shadow banned, which is like crazy because I didn't do anything particularly. But what it was is I used the word pandemic in the title. And I think that was enough to make him go like, yeah, we should probably not. And all I was doing was showing like dead empty streets and stuff, you know, more spooky than anything. But also I talk about if a person is to come to Georgia, what's it like here? Well, you know, where would be interesting places to visit besides the obvious things? Eventually I'm going to do one episode on here's the obvious triangle to visit that everyone does videos on. Because there is. It's like whenever I see a video on Georgia, on Tbilisi, it's like I see the same things over and over. It's like they go here, they go there, they do this, they do that. They're done.
Yeah.
And whenever I meet people, I say, what did you do? He says, well, we went here and here. And I go, okay. Let me tell you about the real things. Let me tell you about the bazaar. Let me tell you about the hike up the mountain. In the town, there's a 2,500 foot mountain in the town. In the downtown area, you can just walk up. I just did a video on that. And also I did some on the differences between Georgians and Americans and their outlook. And there's like strange things like, yeah, there's no mail service here. I mean, there is, but why use it? Because it's impossible to use. You know, it's a holdover from the Soviet era. So I'm going to actually make a video explaining exactly why it's so hard to send mail to me. And just walking up and down my street and showing different things on video going like, okay, well, here's the number on my house. And then and it's just like, and then you open it up and there's six various apartments in different buildings here and none of them have numbers on them. So it's just like, yeah, number 13. Yeah. And then the street I'm on, there's four variations on the same name. And even the Georgians get confused. And there's not a mailbox anywhere on any of the houses. And there's a town of 1,500,000 people, four post office. So you get the picture. It's just like bizarre. But I learn an awful lot here, and I am appreciating it more now. It will be nice to get out, but I can go out and hike. What's nice is 5-minute walk behind me, I'm in the mountain.
Mm.
It's just great.
Yeah.
So check out the Anadromist and Georgian Crossroads. Put links to those for me.
Okay, I'll do that.
Thank you, Paul, by the way, for all the stuff you've been doing. I don't watch everything you do, but I've been watching enough that I'm going like, yeah, Paul's still doing it, still out there plugging away, trying to understand things. That makes me feel good. So,
well, that's nobody needs to watch everything I put out. That's for darn sure. And I'm just grateful that anybody watches anything at all.
Yeah, but that's how I feel.
It's just, you know, I do what I do in many ways for me, because I don't, and you know, as we said too, especially during a pandemic, I don't have my meetups. I mean, it's tougher to get face to face with conversation partners.
What's going on with your church? Are you just sending messages out, helping people watch? And
well, I'm doing Sunday videos,
right,
and you know, Zoom? Some people are watching Facebook and YouTube on the church channel. But most of really what's going on in church is right away we kind of gathered the council and said, okay, everybody needs to check in weekly here. And so there's just a lot of many of my people Zoom. They know how to use a phone. So we pick up the phone and we have conversations with the people and we check up on people and we try to make sure needs are getting met. So that's,
so do you have a certain percentage of people who aren't boomers, but are silent generation folk?
Oh yes. Oh yes.
Yeah. Well, here's what I noticed about them. And I learned this from tours in Alaska. I remember talking to one of the tour operators and she was talking to me and she said, she was the owner of one of these. And she said, those people will really tip you. She says, boomers though, always want much more than they're willing to give.
Yeah.
And there's that divide. And that's the beginning of the divide toward, you know, because the people my mom's age, your mother's age, were people who believed that you had to work, you know, you didn't get above yourself. You know, put your nose to the grindstone. You had to be polite to people. You gave to people what needed to be given. Yeah. You know, if you were going to church, you gave a certain percentage of your money and such. Yeah. Whereas on the other side of that baby boom generation, starting there, it just changes radically. And it's all about me. Yeah. What can you do for me?
It's true. And this church, when that generation dies off, I don't know if this church and many, many other churches, I don't know if they'll make it, because these churches that everyone relies on for little things are really continue to be the legacy of that silent generation.
They're keeping things afloat.
Yep. They are.
You know, sometimes they're stuck in the old mud, but nevertheless, they're the ones who say, yeah, I have to be there, and yeah, I have to give, and yep. Yeah, the stuff's important.
Yep, that's right. That's right. So that's the church.
Okay, side. Paul.
Great we'll talking to you, Bern, as always. I'll post this tomorrow. God be with you. All right.
All right.
You too. Bye-bye.